Okay, so good afternoon. So today we're going to be covering mature material. First, some other things. So first, some non-exam review quiz, anything related to anonymous feedback to address. So question, what are we allowed to use Stack Overflow on labs? Like, what are the rules? Okay, so on labs, you can work with other students in the lab. This is allowed, encouraged. I know many of you don't do this, but you know, the purpose of the lab, being in a lab time, is that you can actually like talk to people. And web info is okay for parts of things. Like, you can look up how to do something on the web that's not the actual problem we're having you solve in lab. Like, you can look up how pointers work in C. You can't look up how do you correctly write a doubly linked circular linked list. That would not be, you know, not the sort of thing for the memory safety lab, for example. You should not be asking questions about it online. So that sort of use of Stack Overflow, no. You can ask on the lab, you can ask classmates, your lab TA. And if you hand in a C or HCLTD file in the lab, you should please cite what resources you used. Do you work with? If you found something on the web that does some part of it, you should cite that in the file you submit. Rules for homeworks are different. Most notably, you should not be working with other students on the homework. But it's the same as far as, yeah, you can get like, you can like look up how pointers work in C. You can't look up how do you append to a linked list and copy that code. I understand you might come across that sort of thing, but by accident, but please do not seek it out. Please do not copy it, the code, if you find it, etc. Any questions on this? Okay. So otherwise, so one question about our lecture recordings, is it possible to make ones with a speed up option? So they're just playing in your browser. We don't actually have a player. So you can right click, save as, and use some player of your choice. I like VLC, which definitely has an option to play it faster, speeding up the audio without changing the pitch. And yeah, that's a perfectly reasonable way to consume lectures, especially if you think you know most of the material. Okay, and with those sorts of non-review things out of the way, I'd like to go to a topic from last time, which was apparently still very confusing even though I spent some time on it, which is bit numbering and I10 bytes and how you get parts of an instruction. So there's two sources of confusion here. So one is that in English language, we basically write numbers in big endian. Our natural order is that the most significant part of the number comes first. This is not how we're storing numbers in memory. And this is not how we're interpreting numbers we read from memory. And the other part of the confusion is that normally in Y86, we've never had a way of talking about bits within a byte by number. We can't say bit 2.5 bytes into a number. We have no way of doing that in Y86. We can't address that memory. So we've never had to be concerned about how do we number bits in a byte. But HCLTD made us concerned, because now we read an 80-bit number and we number the bits. So we have to have a way of numbering each individual bit, not just the bytes. But previously we didn't have this problem. And HCLTD is numbering consistent with the order we store things in memory, that the least significant part has the lowest number. But the main confusion comes that we showed you this table, which is written with bytes that we don't divide into pieces in mind. So this is the first byte of the table. And since we don't divide up the bytes in Y86, the authors of our textbook, when making this table, decided that they would write the parts of the byte in the order we write them in English, which is that the most significant part is first. So this means that in this picture, this bottom four bits is the least significant bits of that first byte, which ordinarily we wouldn't have a number for, but in HCLTD, it's going to be bits 0 through 4. And this top part is the most significant four bits. It's the thing which affects the value of that first byte the most, which is going to be bits 4 through 8 in HCLTD's numbering. And similarly, the next bytes are byte 1, and the bottom part of byte 1 is going to be bits 8 through 12. And the top part is going to be 12 through 16. So the big confusion here is that when we read something from memory as a big number, we're conceptually, if we were writing it in English order, we're moving the bytes around conceptually to make that consistent. But here in this picture, they're showing you how to produce each byte separately, except for the big numbers, V, D, V, and dest, which are in little endian order, they just tell you. So, and they're writing each byte in the English order, which happens to be big endian, because probably doing the opposite would be even more confusing. So another way of looking at this is that if we have a push instruction, what this is telling us is that at x, if it's at address x, then at x plus 0, we look at the 0 in that byte number on the table, or the 0 here tells us this is the 0 byte. So the x plus 0 is push q and the literal f, the opcode part. And then x plus 1, the thing labeled 1 on the table, is rbx and f. And we can encode those. And what HCL2D is doing is you produce these bytes already when you encoded the instruction. And HCL2D is interpreting the whole thing as a little endian number. And when we take a bunch of bytes in memory as in little endian order, they get written out in English in the wrong way, where we conceptually swap the bytes. This is because we're interpreting this byte followed by this byte followed by this byte as a little endian number as a whole. And that's what HCL2D is doing. It's taking actually not 2 bytes, but 10 bytes and treating it as a little endian number. So this first byte goes at the end, the next byte goes before it, and so on, in the English order. This is just a matter of how we translate between numbers and the significance of the value. And the bit numbering in this thing is that bit 0 is the least significant bit. And we number up from there. And one way to help you remember this is that bit 0 is the 2 to the 0's place. Bit 1 is 2 to the 1's place. The bit 2 is 2 to the 2's place, and so on. That's always how HCL2D is numbering things. So I assume people are still confused based on what happened this morning. So questions, comments, confusion, everyone think we should move on? Yeah.
Yeah, so do we need to know the advantage of little endian over big endian?
So the question is, do you need to know the advantage of little endian over big endian? And basically, no. The reason is that it's not clear that there is like a substantial one in any direction. Like clearly, neither big or little endian is a bit problematic. And there are some things on some systems which are that way. But other than that, yeah, we're not going to try to choose between them. We just chose in little endian because that's what x86 uses. That's the only reason we're using it. And it's not something that's neither little or big endian, which, as I said, some systems use that in some places, and it's obviously not a good idea. Okay, other questions? So last time we covered HCL2D, and a big question is it on the exam? So we mostly are covering HCL2D because after the exam, we're going to have labs and homeworks that use it. We might have a bit on the exam as a substitute for drawing a picture of a circuit if we decide that something makes more sense if we give you some HCL2D code rather than drawing a picture. But we're not going to have you write or debug HCL. So other exam review stuff. So generally, what's on the exam? Everything might be on the exam. I'm not going to try to deliberately limit ourselves beyond what I said about HCL2D. So if it wasn't lecture or the lab or the homework or the readings, we might put it on the exam. So the exams are going to be about 75 minutes. It's multiple choice or short answer, very similar to the prior exams that you've hopefully found on the website under documents. There's about 20 to 25 questions, like prior exams, about the same length. It will be during lecture time. It is closed books, notes, etc. And for those of you who've looked at prior exams, I have one notable thing to say about things that aren't on the exam, and that's floating point is not on the exam. There are floating point questions from prior semesters because this course used to cover floating point some. These days, we assume you had enough of that in 2150. So an example exam topics. So we have C, especially pointer arithmetic and arrays, assembly in x86. 64, bit fiddling, basic circuits like how registers work, how the memory components we have in our sequential processor work, ISA trade-offs, the Y86-64, how the encoding works, and how the instruction set is designed, what choices were made, and the sequential single cycle implementation of Y86-64 that we showed in lecture, and this is in our textbook. And if you want a full list of topics, you look at the schedule to see what we did. This is likely how we're constructing the exam. And probably gives you the best hint as to what we might emphasize. Okay, so any questions about format of the exam, what topics might be on the exam, etc.? Yes?
Will the bit fiddling be like as hard as the
question is, how hard is the bit fiddling going to be? The bit fiddling will not be as hard as the lab and the homework because you don't have a C compiler and so on. But so it will be easier than that, but there will probably still be some. Also, I would note on the lab, some of the later bit fiddling problems we didn't expect people to finish. Okay, so some exam review. So first, I have, there was a bunch of anonymous feedback and all sorts of questions on Piazza. You were really confused in the last post quiz. So we'll start by going over that, and then we'll go over, then I'll ask you what else you want me to cover. So let's see if I can do this. So here's last week's post quiz, and we'll just go through each of these questions, and most of them are a substantial number of people didn't get. So the first question here is our single cycle processor, we have a memory address input to the data memory, and often that value could come directly from our ALU. And the question is asking, there were some instructions where it didn't because the ALU had some other use where it wasn't computing an address that we want to access memory at. So in the case of MRMoveQ and RMoveQ, what the ALU is doing is adding up the register value that we retrieve from the register file and the displacement from the instruction. So in those cases, we're using the ALU to compute the address, and that's exactly what we want to tell the data memory, hey, this is where I want to access memory. So then we have these two tricky cases, pushQ and RET. So in the case of RET, the thing that we're computing is we're incrementing the stack pointer. We're adding 8 to the stack pointer. And the place where we want to access memory is the old value of the stack pointer. Because remember, the stack pointer points at something that's on the stack, and that's what RET is accessing from memory. It's accessing the thing that's on the stack now so it can send it to the program counter register. That means the value we're computing is not in the ALU, that adding it to the stack pointer is definitely not what we want to send, so that's why RET isn't something where this is the case where we don't want to use that output as the input to that memory. Now we're going to use something else. In this case, we're going to get a signal directly from the register file. And if you remember, we had this MUX right here, and this question is just asking basically, when does this MUX not select the ALU signal? And that's what the question is asking about. How does the control signal for this MUX work? So pushQ is the one which confused people. So in pushQ, people know, hey, the ALU is being used to decrement the stack pointer. So doesn't that mean it's being used for something else and can't isn't what we're using to access that memory? Well, yes, it's being used to decrement the stack pointer, but it's accessing the exactly the decrement of stack pointer is exactly the address where we want to store a value. And if we use the stack pointer directly, we wouldn't be storing the right value anyways. So yes, it's decrementing the stack pointer, but that is also the same thing as computing the address we want to access. And that's why push queue is not something you should select. So questions about that? Yeah? Yes, pop would be, so the question is, would pop be regret? Yes, pop would be like ret, and call would be like push. Since pop is just, is a ret that doesn't go to the same, is a pop, yeah, pop. Ret is a pop that doesn't go to a normal register, and call does a push and some other stuff. Okay. So, second question here. In the single cycle processor design, some instructions don't use the memory stage. Which of these things are true about those instructions? So the first one here is the instructions change the PC, for now I'll refer to the program counter register, more quickly than other instructions. So when does the program counter register value change? Anyone remember? Yeah. So you're saying write back. So that is not actually a stage thing. I went like what needs to happen for the program counter register to change? So we have to calculate it. Is there anything else which needs to happen for us to change the program counter register? I agree that yes, we definitely need to calculate it before we can change it. Yeah.
Clock has a writing edge.
Yeah. So the program counter register changes once we've calculated the value and set it as the input to the register, and it gets a rising edge of the clock. So it's that rising edge of the clock which actually triggers the program counter to change. Program counter register to change. And the length of our clock cycle, how frequently we have rising edges, if you remember in our single cycle design, was determined by the slowest instruction. This was one of the big disadvantages of having a single cycle design, is that we were limited by whatever the slowest thing data path was. We don't have any mechanism to make the clock cycle shorter when we compute things quicker. We didn't see any of that in our single cycle processor, and it doesn't exist. So our clock cycle time is fixed, and it's fixed based on the slowest instruction. So even though these instructions maybe compute the program counter value faster, it doesn't mean they can actually set it faster. Because the speed at which they set it is not limited by how long it takes to compute it, but by how fast the clock cycle is. Okay, any questions about that? So next thing is when these instructions execute, the address input to the data memory is zero. And to answer this, best way is to look at our circuit here. This is the address input to the data memory, which comes from this mux, which either comes from the ALU or from valet. There's no particular reason to believe that those values are going to be zero. In fact, often they won't be. In the case of an add, both of them are unlikely to be zero. So that means that the address input is often not going to be zero, just because there happens to be some value there. It doesn't matter that it's not zero, because we're going to send a control signal to the data memory saying, I don't want you to do any reading or writing. But that doesn't mean it's going to be zero, because we don't have any machinery in the circuit to actually make the value zero. And the other option, when these instructions execute in an HCL2D implementation, the mem read bit control signal will be zero. And this is how we're actually not going to be reading things. We're not going to send zero as an address, because that's a valid memory address that we don't actually want to read, and we don't care about reading memory, so we're not going to do anything special with the value we send. But we certainly will tell the data memory that we're not trying to read anything, because these instructions don't use the memory stage, which means they must not read a value from the data memory. They read from the instruction memory, but that's not what this is asking of. And finally, we have this option that these instructions all write a value to the register file. So some of them do, but there's some which don't. The most notable example is NOP. I assume this was a gimme because you had your textbook, but I guess people didn't like look over the list of instructions and say, oh, what are these instructions? So any questions about any of these options? Confusion? Okay. So let's look at the next question. So from which sources could the input of the program counter register from? And the way I expected people to answer this question was by looking at the instructions and saying, how does this set the program counter? And most of our instructions set the program counter by taking the current value of the program counter and adding something, which is this option, the output of an adder, which takes the current program counter as input. It also takes a constant. That's the typical case. Then we have two other kinds of instructions. So we have call and jump instructions. And the way they set the program counter is that there's something in the instruction which is the new thing to put in the program counter. So that's for D. So call and jump use part of the instruction memory output to set the program counter. And then we have a third case, which is RET. In the case of RET, we pop something off the stack. The way we access the stack is through the data memory, which means that the data memory output is what ends up going to the program counter. Another way you could have answered this is by looking at this picture and saying, oh, there's the program counter register. What are the inputs to this thing in front of it? And you could have traced these wires and say, oh, this goes to the data memory. This goes to the instruction memory. And this goes to the adder here. And you could have figured it out that way. Yes?
Is there like anywhere on
Is there an unannotated version of that? Besides, so these slides will be posted if you want this version, which I got by opening up Samira's slides in PowerPoint and removing the red thing, and then taking a screenshot. Okay. And finally, a question about what things are legal in HTL2D. So one source of confusion here is that our HTL2D guide says wires can't be used in the same line they're declared. We mean line as in like things which are separated by semicolons, but people didn't interpret it that way, and that might be reasonable, and I might have to drop some of these questions for that. But that's not what I meant. So by the same line they're declared, we mean after the semicolon, the wires are valid. So this is completely valid. There's not a problem that we're using A and B and the same right after they're declared because we have a semicolon after the declaration. So let's start with the general thing about inputs and outputs of built-in components. So they're just wires. All wires in HTL2D behave basically the same, even if they happen to be used by the instruction memory or the register file. The only difference is that the built-in component is using the output of PC, for example, to access memory. So the value is used. And in the case of things which are assigned by built-in components, like i10 bytes, there's a built-in assignment to it, so you can't assign yourself, just like you can't assign to, say, A here twice. The only other way in which they're special is that some of them whose values would be used will do something special if they're not assigned to, like omit that part of the register file for you. But otherwise, they behave exactly the same as normal wires. So with that out of the way, let's look at these examples here. So here, what's reg source A? Remember, looked it up. Yeah.
But which register you want to access from the 16 or 15 that we have available?
Yeah, so the reg source A is which of the 15 registers or no register do I want to access for output A? So it's a 4-bit number. PC is the address I want to access from the instruction memory, which is a 64-bit number, and we can't assign wires of different lengths to each other. So that's disallowed. In this case, we want to assign reg input E. Reg input E is the value that at the next rising edge of the clock, we want to end up in some register. And yes, we can assign that to PC because the values in registers are 64 bits, and the program counter value is 64 bits. So this is legal. Maybe not something you actually want to do, but it's legal. Then we have this example here. So here we're declaring an 8-bit wire and another 8-bit wire, and we're assigning one wire to the other. And remember that in HCLTD, the order of assignments doesn't matter. So it doesn't matter that I haven't set B yet, because the HCLTD is going to run all the assignments in the order we need them to work, all of them every cycle. So this first A equals B is legal. And B equals 4 is legal because 4 is something is a constant that we can fit in 8 bits. And for constant values in HCLTD, HCLTD will just make them fit as long as they're small enough. And we'll add the appropriate number of zeros for constants only, not for wires. So then we have this example here. So here we declare A as a 64-bit wire. And then we assign i10 bytes 2.8. Which is bits 2 through 8 of i10 bytes. So we're trying to assign a 6-bit value to a 64-bit wire. That's illegal. HCLTD is not going to pad it with zeros or anything. If you want to do that, you need to manually specify add zeros to this. Finally, we have reg source A equals 3. So 3 is a valid register number, and as I said, it fits in 64 bits, so this is legal. So any questions about these? Yeah?
So C is legal because you're like assigning the same constants?
So
why? You're not reassigning, you're not setting the wires themselves equal to each other, you're setting up the constants that are voting.
So for A equals B is connecting, is saying that A should have the same value that B has. Mm-hmm. And that's legal because we're allowed to do that with wires of the same width. Mm-hmm. And B equals 4 is saying B should have the value 4, and that's legal because it's a constant that fits on the wire. Yeah?
How do you tell HCLTD to add zeros? Is it hard to fix something?
There's a syntax for this. This is in the write-up. I believe it's something like .a is how you produce a value 0 extend a, but I'm not sure. It's in the HCLTD webpage. Okay. Okay, so with that, now I'm conveniently on the thing I want to be on. So that's the end of my structured portion. So from this point, I will take questions on what things would you like me to answer. So I'll take something you'd like me to explain. I'll take specific prior exam questions. Just tell me, raising hands, what you'd like me to cover. If you don't have anything to cover, I'm done. So, what would people like reviewed? Yes?
Can you go over bit puzzles due tomorrow. I was going to ask you to clarify something.
I can answer questions about bit puzzles. I mean, that is fine.
No, it was just for you to explain your, a function. But I guess that's definitely
not. Okay. Anyone else? Really, no one has some? Yeah, okay.
Can you please explain again the difference between .c file, .s file, object file, and .exe file?
.c, .s, .o, .exe, okay. Other things, topics? Yeah.
Could you just give us a brief overview of the five stages of and
Seek. Okay. Other. Yeah.
Can you give the differences between this and this?
Okay. Other topics? Yeah.
Like list conversions and like heap memory allocation.
Conversions and mallocs and list malloc.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Clocks.
Clock cycle. The yeah. Clock and time. Clock cycles and timing. Okay. Other topics? I will also accept, like, if you have, like, one exam question you want me to go over, which is what's usually happened in the past, but apparently not today.
Can you do heap versus stack?
Sure. Heap versus stack. Yeah.
I know you said floating point numbers wouldn't be on the test, but in the reading and on this, I heard, like, I guess in the bit puzzle, there were questions about, like, bias and, I guess, normalization, too. Is that, like, valid?
So in the
in the
bit puzzles, there's something with bias. We will not ask that on the test,
okay.
But yeah, there is something with the bias, which is just about rounding integers,
okay.
Not floating point.
Okay.
Yeah. Other. Yeah.
Can you go over fall 2016?
Can you tell me the general area?
That's
bit puzzles. Okay.
Yeah.
Other, yeah.
Can you know the ZF
class
and sine
class? ZFSF, okay. Yeah.
The most important is similarities and differences between conditional statements.
Conditional, like
the program flow control
statements
like
IRQ
and
return
and jump.
Okay, so I'm not sure what your jump. Like C loops to assembly?
Sure.
Okay, I'd like something more specific, but we'll try to deal with that when we get there. Other topics? Okay, so let's try to group these a bit. Stages of seek and clock cycles and timing probably go together. Heap versus stack and list conversions and malloc probably go together. SFCF and C loops to assembly probably go together. Okay, so C, S, and that O and EXE. Really? Oh, that's something I did. So the question is, how do these compare? So C file, you know what it contains? It contains C code. Contains C code. That S file contains assembly code. Assembly code has ASCII. That O file contains machine code and data. And data. So both machine code and data. I think there was a confusion that thinking it only contains machine code, but if you have a string, it better be in your .o file. Or else it doesn't end up in your program anyway. Or other data, like a number. And .exe file also contains machine code and data. But the difference is with holes for memory at locations. And this is without holes for memory locations. So the difference, so the .o file, we're not done producing the executable yet. So we don't know where everything's going to end up in memory. We also don't know where some things are in memory at all. We don't have like the copy of printf yet. So there are holes in the .o file for that need to be filled in to produce the executable. And those were called relocations, if you remember. Yes, I have this slide. So if I, so we had our relocations here, which were basically saying this bunch of zeros, you're going to replace it with wherever the data segment ends up. So we have that sort of extra information. So when we get to the executable file, we just get something that we can basically just copy directly into memory. where we don't have, where this is filled in with an actual address, we don't have to worry about figuring out where printf or putS is. So any questions about CSO? Yeah.
So we have a quick question about the Hello World string.
Yeah.
Can you just go through that again and then say why Hello World is a
feature? Okay, so Hello World, it's in the C file, trivially. It's in the .s file, trivially. And so the only tricky thing is, where is it here? Well, it's in the data segment. And I've represented this as hex, but it's not like there's anything which says that it is or isn't really a string just because I've written it in hex. And in a real file, in fact, it's going to be representing using the same bits as it is in here. It's just that you don't usually open up .o files in a text editor, because you'll get lots of junk because this machine code is not very readable in a text editor. And similarly, in the executable, this data segment is going to be copied and there's going to be some place in memory for it, so it's going to appear in the executable. And that's also where it is here. And that's also going to be probably exactly the same bits that appeared here. That makes sense? Yeah.
There was a question about what the labels get turned into.
Okay.
Like by the ISA assembly representation.
Okay, so one example of a label here is main. Another example is putS. So eventually, these are going to become addresses. So the key thing is labels represent addresses. And I assume that's the main thing the question was trying to get at. And there's this intermediate step where we have a placeholder for them first in the .o file because we don't know what the address is yet. But the key idea is that this label here, all these labels, eventually become a memory address or some representation of a memory address. And yeah.
How are the addresses determined when you're doing the linking? I remember, I think you guys said something about how all programs assume they start at the same address.
Yes, so there's a convention on Linux. It looks something like this, is that there's some starting address. And what happens is when you create the executable, the linker looks at all your .o files and just lays them out like this and figures out what the addresses are based on that. This is arbitrary. You can, in fact, make an executable, even on Linux, where your stuff is in different locations. This is not the default. Okay. Other questions about executable formats? Object files, labels. Okay. So RISC versus CISC. So the key idea is that RISC is reduced complexity for the chip designer. So it's about making things easier for the chip designer, not easier for compiler writers, assembly writers, not necessarily lower power, though some things are. Some parts help. So we had some RISC decisions which help with this. So uniform decode, that's easier for the assembly, that's easier for the chip designer. But it's not easier for a compiler writer because it means we have less flexibility in our instruction set. We can not offer as many different kinds of instructions easily. We have fixed length, which again limits the number of sort of variety of instructions we have. We have typically separate memory accessing instructions, so we don't have anything like pop Q push Q because that accesses memory in a register separately. So that simplifies the hardware. Like you saw that pop Q and push Q were some of the most complicated instructions to implement in our single cycle design. In fact, required an extra port on our register file. extra hardware complexity, and here, and so RISC things will commonly not have those. So that doesn't make things easier for the compiler writer, which is, I think, a key confusion. It makes things easier for the chip designer. And RISC sometimes do things, and commonly you'll see RISC processors maybe have more registers, which is something to do with same amount of hardware. Right. Basically, they're saying, well, we've made the hardware simpler, so maybe we have more space now. And one thing you might do with that is more registers. That's why RISC processors tend to, but not necessarily, have more registers. And that's not something which saves power, even though, but these other things are. Not something which saves area, but these other things are. But it's something to do instead of adding more types of instructions that lets you use extra hardware resources. That's easy on the chip designer. It's easy to double the number of registers because it's all, you're just copying something you already have. It's not so easy to add not easy to write an insert into linked list instruction in hardware, which is something else you might do with those hardware resources. Okay. I guess this should be here. Any questions about CISC versus RISC? Okay, in that case, we'll go on to list conversions and malloc. So the three types of lists. So we have our sentinel array, where the representation is a pointer to for and sentinel. We have our range, where a representation is a length and a pointer to the data. And we have our linked list, where our representation is making me regret having 5 elements on my list, where it's a pointer to payload and the next, and a pointer to a payload, and so on. So in these lists, so pointer is on stack or in registers. Thing it points to is malloc'd. And what often we have asked questions about in the past is, how much space does it take up? Well, you just look at what's in there. We need space for 5 elements here, for a 5-element list, and a sentinel. So one allocation, number of elements, plus one element space. In the range, the struct range key is on stack or in registers. And pointer, thing it points to is malloc'd. Malloc'd. One allocation, just number of elements. So this has the minimal malloc space, right? In the case of the linked list, the pointer is like the sentinel array on the stack or in registers, and we have one allocation for every node. node, extra space for one pointer for every node. So the linked list tends to be the least space efficient, though there's obviously some advantages in that you can like easily remove things in the middle because we have this extra pointer for every node. And we also have separate allocations, which means that if you want to resize things, we're not likely to have to make a new big allocation. Right? When you wanted to append to a range or a sentinel array, you need to reallocate the thing that points to as one big contiguous piece, which might mean making a very large memory allocation even if you're only appending a little bit. In the case of appending to a linked list, you're always going to make little memory allocations. That's list conversions. So heap versus stack. So the stack is allocated, is where function local data goes. It disappears at the end of the function because we get things from the stack. Yeah?
Oh, just a question about the linked list. So the amount of space it would take up is the number of elements plus the number of elements times like the space for a pointer.
Yes. So the amount of space on the heap that the linked list takes up is space for the each element and each pointer that the element is paired with. Heap. So data can survive past a function. So anything that survives past a function must be on the heap. So besides things like return values, which are copied on the stack or in registers, anything where you can pass a pointer to it and have it survive past a function must be on the heap. And this is only hitted using malloc, realloc, calloc, etc. Those functions, I should say, operator new, since you know C++, etc. And notably, must be explicitly deallocated. So the general rule of thumb is if things are passed by value, they're on the stack. If they're passed by pointer, they're on the heap, probably. They don't have to be, but definitely if they're passed by value, they're always on the stack. If you're passing something by pointer, it might make sense to have it be on the heap. Questions about this? Okay, so stages of seek and clock cycles and timing. So let's say things that change at the end of a at the rising edge of a clock, of the clock cycle, the end of a cycle, conceptually, is values stored in the register file, values stored in registers, like PC, and values stored in the program, sorry, in the data memory. That's things that change, things that happen during a clock cycle. Any computation returning, reading a register from the register file, reading a value from a memory. So these are the only pieces of timing which are fundamental in our single cycle processor. And you should know when these things happen. Separately, we have stages, which is a conceptual division of the processor into pieces of work. This lets us divide up of designing hardware, doesn't say when things actually happen. So the stages are about helping us figure out what has to happen where in our processor at this point. Later on, you'll make the stages be more about when things happen, but right now, things just happen when the values are available. Computation can happen during the clock cycle as soon as the values are available, and actual updates don't actually happen until that rising edge of the clock at the end of a cycle. but we have these stages we divide the processor into so we can deal with it in pieces, rather than trying to look at PopQ and say, okay, I'm going to design a circuit for PopQ. We can look at PopQ and say, okay, I'm going to design the parts of PopQ that deal with the memory stage. That's the purpose of the stages right now. So later on, we're going to, after the exam, we're going to do something where we make the stages much more about dividing up the processor, but for now, they're just a conceptual division. Any questions on that? No? Surprised. And I guess, do people want me to, so the stages were fetch, which is, so is access, is instruction memory, decode, which is register file, instruction memory plus split. Decode, which is accessing a register file, and a bad name because the textbook splits the instruction up in the fetch stage for some reason. Execute, which is ALU memory, which is data memory, and write back, which is write register file and PC update. And this is just dividing things up so we can separately figure out what do we do with the instruction memory. What do we do to update the PC? Just so we can separate the work. At this point, we aren't actually separating out when things happen in the processor. Okay. So fall 2016, question 20. Let's pull up the old quiz. Under documents, old exams. Fall 2016. Okay. So question 20. Okay. So the question is about how do we figure these things out at all? So let's go through these. So this first one, x or y greater than x and y. And there's note that there's an important condition in the question, which is why you should read questions. Assume their values are positive. It's very useful to know, otherwise you will have a very hard time answering this question. So x or y, that's going to have bits set if they're set in x or in y. And x and y is going to have a bit set if it's in x and in y. So this means that there's going to be at least as many bits set as an x or y as an x and y. And since these are positive numbers to start out with and we're never setting the sign bit, this means x or y must be at least as big. So we have at least as many bits set and there's no negative numbers involved. I'll probably skip b because that question was a mistake. You can easily come up with a counterexample for this, like 1 and 1. It's not true. Okay, so tilde y less than minus y. So a helpful thing to know about negation is from 21, where did I put here? Okay, is this fact, which is just a statement of something you should know from 2150, that negating a value is flipping all the bits and adding one. And based on that, you can figure out that this is true. Just using that equality, you can also test it. Test some values, but it doesn't tell you it's always true. And you can also figure out this statement here, using the same logic, if you, I don't think we've talked about ternary statements, which means you probably won't use it on the exam, because that would be pretty mean. But x question y colon z is equivalent to if x, y, else z. But it returns the value directly rather than which in a statement can't do. So you can figure that out using the same rule that flipping all the bits and adding one is the same as negation. So you can turn these complements, these flipping all the bits, into negations and do the math that way. So here, this is asking, assuming arithmetic shifts, and we have, and so with an arithmetic shift, that means that this negative version is going to have ones in the upper bits and still produce a negative number, whereas this version is going to do the other thing. But you can think of a counterexample for this where the rounding works out differently. So if we have x is 1, the negative 1 shifted over 2 is still negative 1. If x is 1 here, 1 shifted over 2 is 0, negative 0 is 0. And this is because we're doing an arithmetic shift here. And also doing one here, but it doesn't matter because we're doing an error. We're going to shift over zeros with a positive number. Question was not graded. But then we have x or tilde x, which is always negative 1. That's because x or tilde x sets all the bits. And we have x xor negative y. It's less than 0, so negative y has a 1 in the sign bit, x has a 0 in the sign bit, 0 xor 1 has a 1 in the sign bit, anything with a 1 in the sign bit is negative. Yeah?
Wait, why is a true because x and y, like if one of them is negative and one of them is positive?
So in the question it says assume their initial values are positive. That's why. So. Okay. Yeah.
When you put the negative in front of y, that's literally just like multiplying by negative 1, right?
Negative front of y here? Yes, that's multiplying by negative 1. Okay. That's a bit fiddling. C loops to ASM and ZF and SF. So I probably do not have a prepared example of C loops to ASM. No. But I have my prepared example for condition codes. So condition codes. So the rule is SF is 1 if the value computed was negative. This is after any computation. Commonly in x86, you see the instruction comp used to do this computation. Comp just does a subtraction. And ZF is 0 if the value is not 0, 1 if it is 0. And one way you can think about how this interacts with the conditional things is that we're effectively comparing the value to 0. So if And so E means, is the thing you computed equal to 0? NE means, is it not equal to 0? G means, is it greater than 0? And we check the values for SF and ZF based on that. We're only talking about SF and ZF, and we'll only do that on the exam, though in real x86, there's also an overflow flag and a carry flag, which are involved in here. That's just to handle the case where the subtraction overflowed correctly and still make the comparison make sense. But we're not going to test you on that, but you should be aware if you program real x86 that that's what's happening. Okay. So for ZF is 1 if 0, SF is 1 if negative, based on computed value Q. And COMQ is subQ, but it just doesn't store the non-condition code parts of the results. So for C loops to assembly, the general rule, if you want to do this by hand, is first convert to if go to. So if we have while x greater than 0, 1, we can convert this to something with go to. So we'll have some labels so we can go to them. And we'll say if x is greater than 0, well, the thing we want to do is we want to go out of the loop. And go to. So that's the basic pattern for converting it. And the boot body goes in the middle. And from this, it's very straightforward to produce assembly. And one pattern we noticed when we talked about converting in this way is that while loops are not the simplest form of loop, because we have this, what the textbook calls a guard condition here. And we'd really, really prefer to have something like this, which is different, which translates to something with less instructions, where we have and oh, no one pointed out that I did this wrong. I'll make it obvious by doing that. That it turns out that even though we're used to using while loops in C, this most straightforward form to convert into assembly is this do while, where we don't have to negate the condition, we don't have to put a test at the beginning of the loop, and then a go to at the end of the loop, we just do something at the end of the loop. And we have the same code in the email. So, this makes sense. So the general idea is if you have this problem that we can use some loops and you want to convert it into assembly, that you first convert it into this go-to form and then you can think of how that turns into assembly. So this greater than is going to be compq wherever, you know, x compq 0x, you know, and then the conditional go to, and then, you know, jump if x is greater than to loop. Or on y86, this is going to be something enormously complicated of like IR move q 0 into some register, some temp register, then sub q x and 0. -0. Well, we can actually simplify it, but we can just do something like and x and x, and then do something where jg. That's a y86 way of doing it. So ending x and x uses x as the value to test, so we set the 0 flag if it's 0, and so on. Yeah. Yes. And these will be posted, these notes and a screen capture. Yeah. This exam?
Yeah.
Okay. Number 13. Okay, so this is a question asked, after executing and RAX RAX, what are the possible values of SF and ZF? So, and RAX and RAX, what are the possible values that can compute? So one possible value is 0. So we can compute 0 if RAX is 0. Another possible value is 1. You can compute 1 if RAX is 1. In fact, all values are possible. Anything we can fit in a register, we can compute with this statement. This leaves RAX unchanged. So this is just asking, given an arbitrary value, how could I possibly set the condition codes? So this first option here says that the zero flag is one, meaning the value was zero, and the sine flag was zero, meaning that it wasn't negative. And certainly it's possible to have a value that's zero and not negative. Zero is one. Second option is saying the zero flag is zero, meaning it's not zero, and the sine flag is one, meaning it's negative. And we can certainly think of a value where that happens. Any negative number will do it. The next one is saying the zero flag is zero and the sine flag is zero. And we can think of a value which is not zero and not negative, so like two, such a value. Any positive value will do that. Then we have this fourth option, the one that's not correct, which is that the zero flag is one, so the value is zero, and the sine flag is one, so the value is negative. And we don't have any notion of negative zero, so that's not possible. It's in fact never possible to have the condition code set that way. But everything else is possible because this instruction just leaves things as they are. So other questions? People think of exam topics they want covered that we don't have on our list? Yes? Which number? Six. 60?
16.
16, oh, so, okay. That makes more sense. 16, how do we compute? So the question here is, here we have a circuit. So these, it has two registers, that's this A and B, and an ALU that adds its operands. So if these registers initially output one, the question doesn't say, but we assume no overflow, then what happens after three rising edges of the clock? So initially, what we're going to have is that the input into A is going to be 1, is going to be 2, 1 plus 1, and the input into B is going to be 1. So after, I should probably draw this out. So after one rising edge of the clock, it's going to be the case that 2 is in A and 1 is in B. So we have. And then after the next one, we'll have 3 as the input to A and 2 as the input to B. So we're going to have 1, 1, 2, 1, 3, 2, and I can probably switch to. So drawing things very poorly. Pardon me. This is initially, so this is at cycle 0. Wow, okay. 2, 3, and so on. So you just do this work out, and eventually you figure out that next 3 plus 2, that's 5, is the input to A. So after the next rising edge of the clock, this is the first rising edge, the second one, the third one, A becomes 5, and B becomes 3. And we have this same thing going on before. Yeah.
So why does B go up to 2 or down 3?
Why does B go? So B is getting its input from, this is A and this is B. I probably should be using a saner pen. This is A and this is B. So B gets its input from directly from A. So B has whatever value A used to have. So, this is what I meant to be able to do. Okay, so this makes sense? Any questions? Yes?
After A is set to 2, Y is in B set to 2. Doesn't it
Is it good at 10 put after? So after A is set to 2, because these are registers, they get set in the next clock cycle. So yes, they get set, but here we have, so A gets is 1, and that's what sets B. Then A gets set to 2, and later on that sets B. So other questions about? That's what I should have done. And so we have a few more minutes. So if there's no more questions about this problem, other problems people would like me to look at? Questions, topics? Yeah.
Could you talk about the list number? I had to append like 2 to make lists, and then it had to do with like double pointers, and then I had to like recopy the make list. Right? Can you talk about that in terms of like if you can stack and why you have to recopy?
Okay, so append. Why a deep copy? So there's what. So the one reason is because the assignment said a copy of the list. The conceptual reason why is that if I do append list A, list B, and then free list, list B, list A better still be valid. And if you didn't copy A, then freeing list B would make it invalid. And that's the reason we had you do that. So if you didn't make a full copy of all the parts of A, of the list A, and then we called your append function, added to, of list B, and added to list A, then deleted list B, list A would suddenly have pointers to unallocated memory. And if we tried to use list A, we'd get in trouble. Yeah?
So will you assume us to know C calling conventions?
So the question is, will we assume that you know the C calling convention? We assume that you know that x86-64 uses registers mostly. We will not have you memorize which registers those are. We will also assume that you know how call and ret work, which is part of the calling convention, obviously. Okay.